Got it.
Cool. Right.
Got it.
Let's rock and roll.
All right. It's episode 324 of Bourbon Pursuit, the podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman, and before we start today's episode that kicks off our first in a four-part series of Is Bourbon Broken? Here's your weekly bourbon news update. The Speed Art Museum's annual bourbon auction called The Art of Bourbon will auction off some of the world's most hard-to-find whiskeys. It's going to be taking place on September 23rd from 7 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. Eastern. Among the bottles is a rare and numbered Van Winkle Family Reserve 15-year from the 90s. It has a value of around $12,500. There's also an Old Forester Brown-Forman 150th Special Edition Birthday Bourbon that was bottled specifically for Brown-Forman's 150th anniversary, was only made available for the distillery's founding members, and was never sold to retail. There's also a bottle from the 1940s and 1950s of private stock from Park & Tilford, a Woodford Reserve Baccarat Edition bottle, and an impossible-to-find 21-year collector's edition distilled and bottled by Dowling Distillers that has an estimated value of around $7,000. There's also several exclusive experiences that allow bidders to win their own private barrel selections as well. The auction is free to bid, but registration is required at artofbourbon.org. A few weeks ago, I talked about Maker's Mark having a new rental in Bardstown called the Samuels House, and it's been inside the Samuels family for a very long time, and the whole house is filled with Maker's Mark artifacts. It's now available for overnight accommodation starting at $1,000 per night and can sleep up to a total of 8 guests. There's also a one-of-a-kind add-on experiences that can be included as well, with tours of the distillery, dinner pairings prepared from our friend of the show, Chef Newman, and one-on-one time with the former Maker's Mark chairman and history buff himself, Bill Samuels Jr. The University of Kentucky's College of Agriculture is leading a team of industry collaborators on a project that's going to provide the industry with more information to improve the efficiency of barrel production. And this is going to be focused on stave drying, or what's also called outdoor seasoning. So while it's good for bourbon flavor, outdoor drying can also create some problems. There's these things called checks, or what are also known as larger cracks in the staves, and that can increase the barrel's potential to leak and also increase the amount of bourbon that's lost in evaporation during aging, which we all know is called the angel's share. This research will measure the rate of evenness of drying that directly influences stave degradation. They're going to do this by providing detailed data on how faster drying contributes to checks and cracks and degrading development. And Brown-Forman Stave Facility in Jackson, Ohio will be providing 8 stacks of white oak staves at 3 specific times during the year. So during stack construction, researchers will measure the initial weight of the staves. That's going to calculate the initial moisture content, and then it's going to continually examine and weigh them over a period of 6 months. So we'll see in 6 months and see if there's any new updates. And now moving on to bourbon release news. Kentucky Owl is announcing the release of the Wise Man Bourbon. It's the first Kentucky straight bourbon that's been produced and distilled by Kentucky Owl, but also in collaboration with Bardstown Bourbon Company. The product is a blend of Kentucky Owl 4-year-old wheat and high rye bourbons, along with a 5.5-year and 8.5-year-old Kentucky sourced bourbon. This is the first Kentucky Owl release under the new master blender, John Rhea, who began back in June, where he previously served at Four Roses as the chief operating officer. The Wise Man Bourbon is bottled at 90.8 proof and will retail for around $60. Blade & Bow is re-releasing its highly sought-after 22-year-old Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. It will be available in 19 markets, as well as on-site at Stitzelweller and the distillery's Garden & Gun Club in Louisville, Kentucky, but only while supplies last. And Four Roses is extending its lineup of retail offerings with the launch of 50 ml bottles. So they can be coming in 2 of their different bourbons, which is Small Batch and Small Batch Select. And those will be available in regions where it's already available. So welcome to this first part in a series of Is Bourbon Broken? Where we take an in-depth look at a multi-part blog series that originated from Bourbon & Banter. Through these 4 parts, we're going to take a look at a few different things. First is the consumer. Then we're going to look at the secondary market. Then we're going to examine retailers and distributors, and then wrap it up once again by looking back at the consumer. In this first part, as I mentioned, we look at the consumer. And we think to ourselves, are everyday bourbon drinkers the ones to blame for really what's happening? What compels people to stand in line for blends? And ultimately, what can we all do as bourbon enthusiasts to educate the broader mass market? Well, enjoy today's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Dave Baldwin, who writes me on fredminnick.com. We all know the definition of bourbon, and he goes on to cite the definition of bourbon, 51% corn, all the distillation stuff, and new charred oak container, an emphasis on new charred oak container. Dave further comments, I keep thinking about charred new oak containers. Are there any distilleries aging on an oak container that are not barrels? Why did the federal government choose to say containers and not barrel? Well, what a great question you have asked me here, Dave. I appreciate that. So a couple of things. One, there have been some square containers developed in the past. They were popularized by Spanish brandy makers and Spanish winemakers. In Spain, they had kind of a fascination with square barrels, which to me is kind of an oxymoron, a square barrel. But I mean, they're not very popular, but they are used. And the container situation was basically, you know, it's on the books like that, but everyone's always practiced and used as barrels. But barrels is, you know, there was an effort to try and define what a barrel is. And there was a time that a whiskey distiller would not consider a 5-gallon barrel to be a barrel. It would be like a jug, a wooden jug or something. And so there's just always been kind of like this, like hands up to keep it as container. And it ends up being a good part of the, you know, American whiskey conversation. You know, Jimmy Russell, you know, God bless him, the great master distiller from Wild Turkey, celebrating 67 years as the master distiller there, by the way. He used to go around telling people that you could create a charred oak bucket and go over there and fill it up at the still and then dump it 5 seconds later and call it bourbon. Because in addition to that definition that describes that, you know, how it should be made, there is no age restriction on it. So you can age bourbon for literally a second in a new charred oak container and get rid of the new charred oak container and call that bourbon. So that's I kind of like the word container because it gives us something fun to talk about. But there are indeed other vessels that can be used, that have been used. They're just not very common. But you know, you want to keep that open in the event that someone creates a large vat. You know, so an open vat. One day we're gonna see a charred oak vat that is open and allows like open, it allows the water to basically, you know, disseminate, and that's going to come eventually at some point. But so there's going to be other vessels that come around. So keeping it open like that with container, I think, is best for the long haul of bourbon. But if they change it to barrel also, yeah, whatever. That's what everybody's using anyway. So, well, that's going to do it for this week's Above the Char. Hey, if you want to be like Dave Baldwin, hit me up on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. Click that contact button and send me your idea for Above the Char to be read on Bourbon Pursuit. If I like the question, I'll read it. Until next week, cheers.
And they're off for another Get 270 2020 Unicorn Raffle. Your $20 ticket gives you not one, but two chances to win from our lineup of 20 Woodford Reserve treasures, including the grand prize, the rarest unicorn yet, the Woodford Reserve Kentucky Derby 150 Baccarat Edition. Only 150 bottles were made and is just like the one the Derby winning owner receives. Quit horsing around and get your $20 tickets now at give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 0002703.
Ed Bly and Rising Tide Spirits are back again with a new release of Old Stubborn Bourbon. And this release of Old Stubborn is a premium hand marriage of 10, 11, and 12-year cask strength, barely filtered pot still bourbon. It comes in at a staggering 123.8 proof. And the flavoring grain for this one, which the last one was wheated, but this time it's now rye. Rich, sweet, and bold with a long finish that's sure to be another eye-opener. You can order online at Sealbox or thebourbonconcierge.com, and you can even purchase in person at Revival Vintage Spirits, and even now with very few select stores in Kentucky. You can get it now while you can, but be sure to do it because it's not going to last long. From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny, Ryan, and Fred here today, and we're going to be tackling a new series on Is Bourbon Broken? And credit to this actually goes to Brent Joseph. He was a contributing writer to Bourbon and Banter, and it's going to be a four-part series where we're going to evaluate Brent's opinion on the piece, Is Bourbon Broken? And we're going to add our own commentary and expand even further on where we see bourbon trending. So in today is part one of the series of Is Bourbon Broken? And we're going to talk about the consumer. So in Brent's article, he talked about Eagle Rare being on the shelf at Total Wine for price of $28.99 with a sign next to it that says one per customer per day. He noticed people in the sales aisle scooping them up and even asking the employees if there's more in the back. He then proceeded to hand them out to friends that were called to come in and even pick up even more of them. Brent wrote that people were so excited, it's like they had spotted Bigfoot for the first time. All this just for a bottle of Eagle Rare. In this episode, we're going to look at the consumer and how the consumer of the average bourbon drinker has changed over time and how they've created this problem for themselves.
I really like how you just read that story. I was like, ooh, Kenny reading stories.
Story time with Kenny Coleman, everybody.
Like, keep going.
Really setting the scene here. And really, I think that's what we want to do is kind of look at in this four-part series is how has everything changed and really is bourbon broken? We're going to try to find some silver lining when we start doing this as well.
Yeah.
But for all of us too, I kind of want to start at the beginning and look at the rise and the popularity of bourbon. So Ryan, I'll put it to you first. So kind of a softball here. What do you think are some of the biggest factors that have kind of grown bourbon to where it is today?
My initial thought is probably, well, I grew up around this stuff, so nobody really cared about it. So it's really still weird for me to see the popularity of it. I'm not sure it's broken, but we're definitely going through growing pains. And the industry just wasn't prepared for it. But probably the rise, there's many factors, but cocktail culture, to me, like seeing Don Draper, you know, and Mad Men, it even motivated me to start looking at old fashions again or different cocktails. You know, you go out to bars and restaurants, you're trying different things. And then, if not, then the second biggest is probably social media. I mean, just being able to post your finds, post what bottles you're drinking, posting. Social media is one of those things. It's like, it's a highlight reel of your best moments in life, and bourbon's no different. You know, you can highlight the pick you just found or my epic pours and my crazy collection. Look how great this and that and all that stuff is. And it kind of gives you FOMO, and then you got to get more and more to kind of be the best Instagrammer, or, you know, have the coolest photos. And it kind of just creates that desire and need. But two, I think it was kind of a perfect storm, like, because the bourbon industry wasn't prepared for this growth, there's that rarity aspect of it that they didn't have enough product. And so even though you have all this growth and people wanting more, they couldn't get their hands on it. So it kind of gives it, people love scarcity. And so if you have scarcity, people are going to gravitate towards that, because I've always said bourbon's the perfect product because each barrel's individual, it's unique, and you can sell it that way. And two, if you don't have the juice to sell, people are just like, ooh, it's rare and this and that. And then, but once you're in the industry and you walk through a warehouse, you're like, well, it's just another bottle of whiskey. But I think there's multifaceted factors that did that, but that's kind of where I would gravitate towards.
Would you think that Fred Minnick is the reason that bourbon is as big as it is today?
Well, there's definitely a Fred Minnick effect. I've noticed in my own Total Wine or any liquor stores, it was with, you know, rum. I was trying to get off bourbon because I was pissed off at it. And then I was like, ooh, I have this nice category of rum. And then Fred starts talking about rum and now I can't get the rum I want anymore, you know. So there's definitely that too. And you know, us, the media is probably, you know, I don't want to take all of them away, but
well, you know, I look at it like one of the things about this category is we love to complain. We love to complain in this category. And it's pretty unique because, you know, you see it a little bit in tequila. You don't really see it as much in the higher end wines because that's people are priced out. And what bourbon is and why everything is changing is it's a price discussion. And bourbon is absolutely 1,000% broken from a pricing structure. And it goes all the way back to the 1940s. When the distilleries tried to get together and fix the prices, and the Senate had all these judicial hearings and broke it up, Pappy Van Winkle ironically was basically telling everybody that the big distillers are outpricing or underpricing everybody and hurting the category, and he was trying to stop like price fixing, and so from that point on, you had laws came into effect where distillers could no longer tell a retailer how to price the product, you know. So whereas like Mac, if anyone sells an Apple computer, they get told, you can't mark it up. This is the price. And that's it. With bourbon, it is up to the retailer to price it how they want. Now things can change backdoor here and there, but that's how it is on the books. The retailer or the distillers cannot influence that. And so the rise of bourbon, you know, does begin in the 1980s when it's basically left for dead.
Yeah, I think you wrote a book about this.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. A little. I mean, sorry, you know how I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I get going on this stuff. I just don't shut up. But, you know, Japan starts drinking bourbon at a high level and creates this demand over there. And so all of these products like Blanton's, Booker's, Noah's Mill are all developed for the Japanese market. The Japanese market busts in the early 1990s. At the same time, they're starting to see trickles of people travel to Kentucky just to visit the distilleries, the Bourbon Trail. Then you have the internet come on. Then you have like Whiskey Magazine, Whiskey Advocate, then Malt Advocate come on. So you start seeing little trickles of media. Then you start seeing things like straightbourbon.com comes out in 1999. And you have like this groundswell of all these people getting into it. And Weller 12-year-old was $20. And that was where things were. And as that spread, things grew to like where we were meeting at a gazebo at the Kentucky Bourbon Festival. And then as that spread, Facebook groups come on, all of these things start coming on. And that's fantastic. More people are into it. But what's happening for the first time in bourbon history is that so many people are coming on, retailers are making decisions to increase prices. And this is going to be in an upcoming episode, the secondary market is created, but all of these prices continue to rise and it's pricing out consumers. And then you have new brands come on to market and they're coming in at $200 while Knob Creek is still 30, 35. And so what we have here where bourbon is broken is that it is a pricing situation. And I'm not an economist.
Yeah.
I don't know how to fix this other than get people together and do something illegal and like say, hey, we can't go over this price. But that's to me, that is where bourbon is broken.
Yeah,
that's a pricing situation.
I've never really thought about it from that angle, but that's a good point because with bourbon, it had such a low cost of entry to get into it. You know, an expensive scotch or expensive wine collecting, you know, you're up in thousands and thousands and thousands. And even now, you know, if you want what's allegedly the world's best bourbon, Pappy Van Winkle, you're paying, you know, $2,000 for secondary market. But more or less, you're going to pay somewhere in the few hundred dollar range as like a really, really, really premium bourbon. And then you're probably mid to, you know, it's going to be $50 to $60, which are great. So it's got a low cost of entry. So that also makes it appealing too. I never thought about it from that aspect.
Yeah. And that's, to me, that's like people would, you know, to start in cognac, you know, a VS bottle would have been, you know, $40, like a good VS bottle or VSOP would have been $55, you know, but back in the day, I mean, back, we're talking 1999 to 2005, you could buy Weller 12-year-old for $22-25.
Hell, you could buy the Elijah Craig, like 18 and 20s for like, what, $35-40?
Exactly.
You know, and I thought like, holy shit, I'm blowing my whole paycheck.
That's
on
exactly
it.
Right. And so when you really look at what is bourbon and then going back, and I want to applaud Brent for writing that story. It actually reminds me of how I used to be in liquor stores. I would be holed up at a liquor store for very early in my career, just watch people and how they made their purchasing decisions. And so I applaud that story that he did. And it is going back to the very beginning of that story. He talked about Eagle Rare being $28 or something like that. And you have new products Jim Rutledge's Blue Run, good bourbon, $150 to $250. You have Kentucky Owls that are coming out of the gate with $1,000 SRP. And I want to ask the question, is it better than that $28 Eagle Rare? I would say if it is, it's not by much. And that is what the problem is. The problem is that distilleries continue to inaccurately, you know, SRP their products, but at the same time, they hold on to this dream and hope that somebody can fall in love and afford the bourbon. And so you have two sides of here. You have one is that the market is no longer in 2005 pricing, but you have these distilleries who still dream and hope that it can stay that way. And it gets the retailers either mark it up or people are buying it and, you know, flipping it. And of course,
for sure.
That's the next episode.
Yeah, we'll talk about that too.
It is fascinating because bourbon has been priced so low, and then these distilleries are cranking out so much juice in anticipation of it being there. So it's like they're kind of like strapped hold. They're like, all right, we need to hang on to these prices because here in the future, we're going to have so much product sell. We don't want to price out our everyday consumers. And that's what I assume most brands want, is an everyday consumer that they want, you know, your Buffalo Traces, Eagle Rare, mm-hmm, you know, right, those products to be, because that's where it's scalable. That's what makes the most money. You know, limited releases are nice and all, but they're more of a pain in the ass than anything. And so they're kind of in that quandary too. It's like, okay, we have this really rare product now. We should raise price it, but here in the future, we're going to have a bunch. So we don't want to like price ourselves too far out of there.
Yeah. And I think that's right. And I don't think there's not a template for going from basically, you know, 15% demand to like 200% demand. And in what would be in business would be overnight if you look at it from a, you know, 5 to 10 year process. Because what we're talking about here, we're talking about the supply today is would have been for Eagle Rare would have been the demand of 2011 because it's a 10 year old product. And so the forecasting for this becomes extremely difficult. And the greatest forecaster of bourbon in history was Bill Samuels Jr. That man could like spot a trend, see where it's going, and know exactly what to do with Maker's Mark in 5 years. And that's when, you know, when he gets out of the game a little bit, you start seeing some shortages because he was so good at forecasting that stuff. And that is in itself is like right now the demand that they're cranking up, this is a 2035 problem. This is a 2030 problem. You know, so today's bourbon is for 2030, or if it's a 9 year old. So I think that that solution is, it's not an easy one, but it is, the pricing is killing bourbon. It's really killing bourbon. And I don't know the answer to it, but from that perspective, in my eyes, it is broken.
I feel like we're at a time when you find a band that plays in your local coffee shop and you're like, yeah, I really like them.
Quills?
I'm gonna follow them. And then you realize they're opening up for a big band. You're like, oh, cool, I'm gonna go see them in concert. And then you realize they're now on tour and they're headlining. And you're like, well, I just lost.
And then they win a Grammy and you're like, I don't like them.
Yeah, I don't like them anymore. They're too popular. And I think that's kind of like where we are with bourbon. And, you know, some of us that have been in a while, you talk to some people that have been longer than us. And yeah, they've moved on to their spirits and kind of like that. And it is kind of unfortunate when we think about it, because everyday shelf items that were Eagle Rare, they were Blanton's, like they're really not shelf items anymore. People are turning them into modern day trophies. And you do see people lining up just for bottles of what we would consider regular shelf items. Now we know that Buffalo Trace is pretty highly sought after in just regards of everything that they're cranking out. And, you know, we can give theories on why that, but I kind of want to move on to a little bit is, do we feel that today's consumers are more educated now than they ever have been?
Yes, I do 1,000%. One thing I have noticed last year, I did in the last year, I've done probably virtual tastings for probably around 50,000 people. And those are private virtual tastings where people book me or it's in person and I'm in front of an audience and educating them. And when I started doing this at the Kentucky Derby Museum in 2013, and I would have 500 to 1500 people there doing these education processes, the number one question, well, I thought bourbon had to be made in Kentucky. I don't get that question anymore. And I don't get the question anymore, is Jack Daniel's bourbon anymore? I mean, it happens. I do get it, but it's no longer a top five question. Now they know the brands. They know the brands, and they even know about MGP. And these are not, an example is I just did a tasting for the athletic trainers for the NHL. Like they have a specialized trade association. And almost every single one of them knew the basics of bourbon. And it was very impressive to me because these are not people that I was assuming they would be novice. Maybe they'd be drinkers, but I didn't think they would know what still proof was and stuff, but they knew those things. And I think all the tourism and all the people that I've touched, all the people that have come through the bourbon trail, those people come out of those facilities and they are instant experts and they influence the people they work with when they're at family gatherings and everything. The education right now for the basic consumer, I would say is probably higher, you know, now than any time in whiskey history. Probably not at wine level, but very high.
So I'll throw another curveball at you though. If the education level is so high, why are people still standing in line for Blanton's?
That's what I was saying. Probably the most people have been educated ever, but it's still not enough. I can't tell many times anywhere I go, and it's so awkward to tell people. I was telling Kenny this the other day, like telling people what I do, you know, with recording a podcast, doing a brand, this and that. But every time that they always bring up, man, I had a shot to get Blanton's the other day, or I had to get, you know, the thing that everybody else wants. And they're like, well, why do you like that? Or, you know, why do you think that's special versus this or that? And a lot of people, you know, I'm amazed, like my neighbor just moved here from California and, you know, he goes to Total Wine and they're pushing him on Black Ridge. And he's like, I really like this, you know, and then he goes to Costco and he's like, I really like the Kirkland's one too. And I go, well, no shit. They're the same damn thing. And it's like, it's made by Barton, you know, Sazerac owns them and they're a contract distiller. And they're like, oh, they're like, holy shit, you serious? You know, and there's still so much education. See,
that's a PhD level education in a lot of ways.
Yeah, sure.
The whole Blanton's thing, I think it's the same reason why the Dallas Cowboys are America's team. You know, there's just some things that just carry on and they don't make any sense. You know, Dallas Cowboys haven't won a Super Bowl since the 90s. They stink. Hopefully they have a good year for them. But Blanton's just...
No offense, Dallas Bourbon Club.
Yeah, sorry about that, Brian. But, you know, Blanton's just has that look and feel. I mean...
It does.
It just feels like Kentucky. But at the same time, too, if there's a bottle there, it's SRP, and it's in the store and I'm walking by, am I buying it? Probably, you know? Am I going to, if I have the option to have a Blanton's barrel pick, I'm going to take it.
Oh, of course. I mean, we fell in that. We were at Buffalo Trace and they're like, we got Blanton's today and it's in a special Derby bottle.
And
like,
they're in. Right.
Yeah, I know. And I felt the need to say, no, I don't really want it. But I was like, well, I mean, part of me. Yeah. So,
we don't want to sell.
But part of me is like, well, I mean, you just can't say no.
Therein is why people stand in line for Blanton's. We just answered our own question. Same thing for Bourbon and Beyond. When we had an opportunity to get a Blanton's Blanton's, you know, for Bourbon and Beyond, you know, we jumped on that like that. So that's why.
I've thought about this a lot. It's like, okay, and it sucks for us early adopters, you know, who were gravitated towards this early on and when it was just starting to get popular and we had great access to all this stuff. And it sucks right now because we don't want to camp for Blanton's. We don't want even the Weller's or anything, you know, special release. But it's like, all right, is what we're going through necessary, and then we'll get back to what we were used to, you know, here. Did we have to go through this necessary evil of growing pains to get to where, yes, everything's back to us, you know, eventually? Because if not, maybe it, you know, it just would never have gotten what, you know, maybe it would always be rare and we would always have to.
I've brought this up before in past episodes, but we always focus on Buffalo Trace. And the reason why is because Buffalo Trace has mastered how to do releases. They have mastered how to break out make the bottles special. And no other distillery does a good job at that. And I think, you know.
And they also have great bourbon, too. Let's not.
Yes, they do.
Right at that part.
You know what? I'll push back a little bit. They do have good bourbon, but if Jim Beam would come out with something similar to the Antique Collection and give us some 12-year-old Maker's Mark cash drink or something like that, go toe-to-toe. Give me, something from, some of those older ryes that they have. It would go toe-to-toe with Buffalo Trace Antique Collection. If Heaven Hill would maybe do the same, but focus a little bit more on the Elijah Craig 18-year-old, don't go past 18, but stay, you know, between 12 and 18 years old. Now, I think we would see a very similar competitor to Pappy. But the other companies that I'm mentioning here, they're really big into volume. They're big into volume, and they're big in like those enormous case sales. Sazerac is big into volume on their Wheatley vodka, on their Fireball, but they are not in volume when it comes to their bourbon. They are very laser focused on that being super high quality.
Yeah, I was reading about one of Mark Brown's newsletters recently, and they were talking about how Evan Williams is the fastest growing bourbon brand in the world. And, you know, to do that, that's it at the expense of all your Elijah Craig, your Henry McInnes, your hyper age stuff, your rare stuff. You know, it's like if you're going to focus on your volume, you're going to sacrifice, you know, your limited release stuff. And I think maybe the problem is people are so focused on limited release stuff. That's why maybe they feel like there's a consumer problem. Whereas reality, there's still a lot of great products on the shelf that, you know, are $25-$35, you know.
There's a lot of great stuff on the shelf at $25-$35. And you know, Evan Williams is right there in the thick of it. That Bottle and Bond is really good. But when it comes down to it, you know, if you're a company, you want to make some money. And that's how you make money in this business, is volume.
And Fred, make a very good point, is that they are laser focused in what they do. And they do a fantastic job of continually putting out press releases, even if it's just minor variation changes of what they are doing to their product. And who does that get the attention of? Well, if you're listening to this podcast, and definitely the people that are sitting around me right now, like, we would probably be considered the one percenters of bourbon.
Yeah.
We are the people that care, that pay attention to what's going on. The other 98%, 99% of the population, they don't care. They don't care. They'll go to the store and they'll pick up a regular bottle of Elijah Craig. They're not going, and they've got to chase down a bottle of Weller 107. They don't care about that,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's a little bit different, you know, when we think about it. So, yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, you are one of the very few people that this is actually speaking towards and that it's going to. Mm-hmm. Now, when we try to think about, okay, the other 99% of the population out there, and, you know, we talk about, yes, we are in a very educated market right now. How do we educate the other people? Like, how do we make them more aware of, you know, when they show up, they don't have to show up for Blanton's. Like, how do we educate those people that are either working in the stores or anything like that to say, like, there's other options out there. Go get yourself a bottle of Russell's Reserve. Go get yourself something.
Yeah, and
like
never
this.
Forget, too, that half the country does not drink. So when we kind of, like, open up, like, the population here, you know, there's about 8 million verified, you know, bourbon drinkers who are willing to listen to a podcast or read a magazine article and get educated. So 8 million's, that's a good number, you know, but this is a big country, and 8 million's a fraction of that. And getting those, the problem that stands in the way with the other 99% of the people getting educated are the whiskey brands and their marketing people who don't give two flips about actual education. What they're trying to do is sell that bottle. And you want to sell that story so hard about how good the proofing water is and the recipe and the yeast. And they sell it so hard. And that's all they care about, is moving that product, because that's what their bonus is based on. That's what their 401k is based on. It's everything. They do not care about educating the category. They want to move that bottle.
Well, yeah, and two, these companies aren't just bourbon brands. They have a whole wide portfolio of other spirits that they're trying to push and trying to sell. And so it's like, okay, how can we grow our business as a whole, not just bourbon? Bourbon's on fire now, but it wasn't, you know, years ago. So vodka was the focus, you know, and it's like, so they're also
chasing the shiny red ball.
Yeah. They're just chasing. And back, you know, 5-6 years ago, you used to have the master distiller go and do talks at Liquor Barn down the road and educate consumers. And there's not really that much anymore.
I remember Jimmy Russell handing out little thimbles of Wild Turkey at Liquor Barn. Hey, Fred, here's some Wild Turkey. I was like, why don't you have a regular glass? This is all they give me, you know?
Yeah. But now you're leaning on a sales rep at a liquor store to educate you, and they're incentivized by other things. And so it's like, you got to look at the incentives to what people are getting educated on. Probably you follow it, it's not to bourbon.
No, but this is why we are powerful. When I say we, I'm talking about everybody listening to this podcast. We are a loud, very vocal community in bourbon. And there's a reason why this article came out and asking the question, is bourbon broken? It's the reason why bourbon will always get the attention of the Pernod Ricards, of the Moët Hennessys, of the Brown-Formans, you know, these large parent companies, is because we won't shut up. We love to complain. And this is the whole fact we're here talking about this. Whiskey media has become powerful, you know? I mean, it's big. And beyond that, you know, Reddit's over 100,000, you know, probably close to 200,000, you know, subscribers. Vodka doesn't have that, cognac, I don't think has that. I mean, we have a very loyal, willing to learn audience, that will be pulling through, much like how bourbon came back. Bourbon didn't come back because of the smart marketing initiatives by Beam or somebody. It came because, you know, you had a handful of people in those organizations who were listening to consumers who were traveling to Kentucky, and they would continue to try to feed those consumers. That's what's happening now, is that consumers are telling these companies what they want, and the companies are reacting. The companies are not pushing this on it. We are pulling it. And the three of us, well, you guys have a brand, so you don't count. I'm a consumer. But at the end of the day, it really does matter about growing that 8 million, in my opinion. When I said the 8 million, that's something that I was able to, when we started Bourbon Plus, we were able to look at all the people who drink and all the people who will be willing to read or listen to something. So there are 8 million people right now who are willing to learn about bourbon. That's statistically verified. So how do we grow that?
There's
niche?
8 million, and they're, you know, and a special release is only 10,000. You know, you do the math really quick.
That's one side of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
The other side is well, what's this over here? Oh, is it Pursuit United? Huh, I've not had that. Let me check this out.
I wish we could. I want to hear some more of those stories if they ever surface.
Yeah, that's news to me.
You know, and Ryan, you had mentioned earlier about social media, and I think this is definitely one thing to talk about of how the consumer is feeding this animal too, is because Facebook kind of built and killed bourbon all at the same exact time.
It did.
When I remember probably joining some of the Facebook groups back in 2014, there was one with an acronym of SWT for anybody out there who's been around for a while.
That was a good one.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's when I realized that there was so much more for me to be educated on. I mean, I used to see people, you know, selling bottles of Willett Family Estate. And I'm like, where do they get these things? I had no idea I could drive an hour and a half down the road. Like this was like a whole thing that I was learning. I mean, do you all remember some of your earlier thoughts of what this was going to open? Because social media and Facebook has played a critical role in bourbon culture now.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/bourbon.
Social media and Facebook has played a critical role in bourbon culture now. And so when you all first started seeing these groups, like, were you thinking like, wow, there's some things I had to learn, or this is just going to be bad news in the end? Like, where were your thoughts?
Well, when they first came out, would we say 2010 to 2013?
That's usually, I mean, that's kind of like the rise of, yeah. I joined like around 2013, 2014 time.
So obviously, so when these were coming on, you know, I'd already been in the business for a good 6 years or so. I remember seeing like how people were commenting about stuff and you know, like how judgmental they were on like any kind of contract or distilled or sourced whiskey. And then it was like the whole state of distillation thing kind of coming on and everyone was like, brr! And what I noticed was my first thought was this is like a protection area for consumers and is calling out. And it's basically Chuck Cowdery, you know, the godfather of American whiskey writing, myself and a few other people would, you know, we would do stories on lawsuits and call people out for not doing the state of distillation. We put 40 hours into an article that would be very thorough and facts. And what I noticed is like people just got on there and chimed off something. I was like, you don't have any proof of that. And you don't know that's true. And that's a lie. You don't know that. And I saw a lot of people being very passionate about it, whether they were right or wrong. There was a little fire kind of being created in Facebook. And it was fun. It was fun to follow. And I miss seeing the old bottles pop up. You know, that was my favorite thing, was to see the old bottles, because, you know, I have all this history on them and I knew who would own them and where they'd come from. And sometimes I'd get tagged to help explain what a bottle was. And I miss those days. And I can't be on those forums anymore anyway, but there was something special about that. And early on, it was mostly collegial, but any kind of like, negative energy was always put toward, you know, a brand trying to deceive consumers. So that's how I looked at the Facebook groups very early on.
Yeah, for me, it was eye-opening, because you're like, well, wait a minute, people care about this, you know, these brands that I can get every day, you know. And then, two, for me, it was enlightening, the, you know, brands I never would have given two thoughts, like Old Scout or OKI, you know, these MGP source brands at 10 to 13 year old whiskey that you're like, you know, it's all for me. You know, I'm not going to, you know, mess with that. It's, and then, boy, was I stupid. But but to the Dusty factor, like I wouldn't have known about Dusty's if it weren't for those strong water trading. Or shoot, I shouldn't have said it. But
it's okay. It's completely gone now.
I wouldn't have known about it or the history of these bottles or got to try any of them. I bought a lot of stuff on there and traded a lot. It was I missed those lotteries and all that stuff. I really enjoyed those, just because you had these unicorn crazy bottles that maybe I have a 35-1 chance to win it, you know, and I never won. But it was like going to the casino, and then you were learning about the bottles too, like why they were special. And same thing too. I mean, I grew up around Willett and know the Colesveen family too, but it's like, well, wait a minute, they're just that distillery up on the hill, you know. Why is their stuff so, you know, why was that so special? And then you come to find out it's all Stitzel Weller and United Distiller stuff that's old, and these ryes, you know, magical rye bottles, they got, you know, the history behind all that. So it was definitely cool. And what? I miss all that.
And that's kind of what it goes to, like, say that, like, if Facebook built bourbon, like, this what started building a community around it. It was to the point where we had friends that were starting in bourbon, like, here, let me add you these Facebook groups. And then you got to the point where I mean, the first episode of Bourbon Pursuit that we ever recorded, Ryan, we sat together and I talked about how I created a Facebook Messenger group, and we would go and we would tell each other tips about, you know, where you find things. And then it became these like regional groups, and like the biggest one that came in Louisville was, you know, Louisville Bourbon Hounds. And now, right. Now rest in peace in that group. And, you know, it skyrocketed from just a couple hundred people to like over 15 or 25,000 members.
Was that Owen's group?
It was a long time ago. And that just amplified, I think, the consumer problem, because now nobody could even get anything, even if you went to your store every single day. But it also brought about a new kind of consumer that I think most of us didn't really like to see. And that's the one that just relies on others too much, of people that would just take pictures of saying, look at the store, like, what's good here? Facebook built Bourbon Up so much that it kind of gave people an easy out on wanting to do their own research.
Yeah. It did. And what we've learned is people don't know how to use the search button.
That's true.
You know,
that is true.
That was one of the things that I learned is that, and the mods, the moderators, they love pointing out, use the search button. So that became a kind of comical for me.
And I remember those search groups, and they were great at first. And then you're like, wait a minute, I'm cannibalizing myself here, you know, and like, it's kind of, you know,
and you started creating your own like group inside of each one of these that they would go and they would post something and then they wouldn't tell you exactly where they got it from. And it defeated the whole purpose of what some of these things were about at first.
Yeah, I remember I sent you a message one time, Party Mart, like it was like their derby where they release a small amount of Van Winkle.
Every spring, by the way.
Every spring. So I go to Party Mart and I'm like, you got anything? And he's like, yeah, I got some. And it gives me a 12-year. And I was like, that's why I sent the message again. I'm like, just got a 12-year at Party Mart. He goes and they give him a 20. And I was like, what?
Wow.
I feel like you owe me that 20.
I think it's also because I had my mustache at the time. And me and this guy, we had this like this beard connection going on.
Yeah, I'm going to take a 20 when I leave here today.
But I mean, this also, like I said, it grew to the point where it kind of like a little bit backfired on itself. And there was no ability for people to go hunt bottles. And that's, I think that kind of killed hunting for a lot of people as well.
Yeah, because it gave we have a lot of friends that are not as into bourbon as us, but they're still into it. Mm-hmm. But they're just educated enough to where they're, you know, consuming all the good bottles, you know, taking all the good bottles off the shelves.
Or when they come to our house,
we teach them about it and then they become, you know, part of the problem. But, you know, I think in the end, overall, this will be a good thing. But now we're in the dip, you know, it's definitely a struggle, you know, as an early adopter, because you've seen so much taking away from you, but I think it'll be better in the long term for us.
You know, the other thing is, let's talk about Instagram a little bit. So Instagram is full of people that just take pictures of full bottles and they put them out there. And I don't know if that helps even fuel this anymore, because granted, we're problem too. We get media samples sent to us, and we're not obligated, but we are encouraged to help spread the word of these new releases and what we're tasting. And that helps build the hype machine behind it. So people will run out and want to go get it. And, you know, granted, we have, you know, our accounts are on like 50,000. There's some that are over 100,000 people. And there's people that just take pictures and repost stuff of, you know, people finding stuff at local stores of a Costco find. Are we feeding the animal too much here when we're doing this?
Yes, but I mean, it's like, okay, what's our end goal here? Do we want to grow the category, or do we just want it to be ho-hum so we all have bottles? And to me, I want to grow the category and keep it growing, because I think just in the past, say, 5-6 years, it's changed dramatically, even from 10 to 12 years ago. Bourbon has become, you know, rare bottles to this and that, but now it's turned into like this visitor experience thing, and where you're going to distilleries and you're spending whole days and you're going to these great restaurants, you know, in Bardstown or Frankfurt or wherever. And it's like, okay, do we want this to be as renowned as Napa or Sonoma? Do we want to be as big as wine? And I do. And I think that we have to do this stuff to keep it growing. I mean, that's going to be at the expense of us, you know, in the short term, but I think long term, it'll come back around. If we continue to push and grow the product and category now, I think it'll be better for us long term.
So, you all brought up the Minnick effect earlier, and I really very rarely talk about this, but, you know, it is true that in my career, when I have said something is good, it sells out. That does happen. And I've seen some things about me saying like I do it on purpose, whatever. I love what I do. I'm never going to apologize for, you know, sipping whiskey for a living. I earn my living drinking whiskey, and people pay to bring me into parties to drink whiskey with them. And I am never going to apologize for that. I have the dream job. Maybe my liver would disagree, but I love what I do. I absolutely love it. I love the history behind it. I love the tasting process of it, of every competition I've ever been a part of, I'm proud of. And like, I understand that, you know, the media samples and all that as part of, I try not to have media samples. I try to buy the stuff that I'm reviewing, even though I have a constant disclaimer in on my channel or wherever I'm at or on my website, that they're media samples, you know, just because I can't keep track of how much stuff I have and whether it's a media sample or I bought it. But I think that it's just like being a sports reporter. If you're the top sports reporter, you're going to the Super Bowl or the Kentucky Derby and you're not paying and you're getting put up and you're getting fed for free and all these kinds of things. This is what it's like to be a professional spirits media. And you know what? Not everybody can do it. I've seen so many people fall out because they drink too much or they piss off the wrong people or they don't have the wherewithal to figure out how to make a living in it. And it is part of the process. So that hype machine and like what is Instagram to that, I look at what I do and what any reviewer does very differently than taking a bottle photo. You know, that's part of the lifestyle. But like reviews, if somebody is giving positive reviews because they're getting samples and just so they can keep getting the sample train, then you know what? That's going to show in your views and people aren't going to listen to you or watch you or read you. But if you're honest and, you know, you get a shit whiskey, you need to say it. You know, you need to say it in your own words, however it is. You know, for a long time when I was with Whiskey Advocate, I was under certain restrictions with what I could, you know, how I could score something. I mean, you have to follow however you're scoring something. I would say it would go good in a cocktail and people would figure that out.
You're like, we can read between the lines on this.
Yeah.
Now, Fred, I guess another question for you is when you are doing reviews and you're doing these different things, do you find it more satisfying when you can find a hidden gem of a distillery that's going to be a everyday shelf item versus like, oh, here's the next BTAC release. Let's go ahead and let's get this review out there. Like what gets your heart pumping there?
I get my favorite things to review are, well, I'll review anything. And I think that's probably, I'm at a point in my career where I really do think I should stop, you know, tasting some of the new stuff that's coming out that I know is going to be bad. Sometimes it takes my palate 2 or 3 days to recover from something that's bad. And that's true. I'm thinking about having someone come in and like, oh, welcome to the team. You are drinking batch 60, one.
60 from, day old. Yeah.
From 60 day old distillery. But I think my favorite thing to find that I get really excited about would be the smaller distillers when they've got something in the game. When I did that Pappy versus the Field and you stocked me with all the blind samples and you put in Woodinville, that was probably the most exciting discovery that I had when I did that. Another one, I put the Bradshaw bourbon in a blind tasting and it took second in a pretty decent field of tasters. And so like, I like getting things that surprise me, but I like doing it blindly. I don't like tasting something and knowing what it is and giving a review that way. I do it as blind as much as I can. So those are two examples I can think of.
So I'm going to shift gears just a little bit to look at one more thing that Brent had actually written in this article. And that's talking about consumers, how they are getting smarter, but they're getting smarter to the point where they're chasing bottles that have dump dates to commemorate a birthday, a child's birthday, an anniversary, whatever it is that makes that bottle, you know, seem special in their eyes or anything like that. Does this make them part of the problem? Is this why bourbon's broken too? Or is this just a novelty?
It's tough because because with that, there's a lot of enthusiasm and passion, you know, and to care about that stuff, that means you care, you know, somewhat about the product or the category. But it is kind of annoying too, because you're like, well, I mean, I've had plenty of Four Roses barrels that weren't tier six, and they're pretty damn good, you know, or, you know, it's just, you know, all or the batch numbers or this of Stag Juniors, like you got to get these batch certain batches now. And you're like, well, I mean, it's pretty good as, you know, it's been pretty good for a while, you know, but I get it. And that, and once again, that's why bourbon is the perfect product, because you can, there's something about it that you can say is rare and unique about this batch or that barrel or this tier or that facing warehouse or that warehouse, Camp Nelson versus Tyrone or whatever. You know, there's all these little, because there's so much, there's so many factors in bourbon that contribute to what it is, the finished product and the glass. You can pick any one of those and make it unique. And so it's cool, but it's also a little annoying.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I remember a gentleman reached out to me on Instagram. His wife had passed away, and her name was Dot, and that was her nickname. And he reached out to me. He's like, Fred, I need help finding Dot's batch of Booker's. Is there any way you can help me? So I put it out on Instagram, and he, within like 5 minutes to 25 minutes, he had a couple people willing to send him a bottle. And to this day, he like tags me in the bottle when he's tasting it. And I think there's something about, you know, the human spirit of like, we like remembering incredible moments, like and people in our lives. Like anytime I see an old Oscar Pepper, I buy it because my son's name is Oscar. And it just, I buy Oscar sardines for the same reason. There's just something special to me about my son's name. And same with my other son, Julian, who, by the way, is not named after Julian Van Winkle. He's just named Julian. But there is something about bourbon that taps into that emotional spirit of who we are. And so there's a little bit of a part, just kind of like, let's move past that one. You know, let's not judge people for wanting to get
I'm totally okay with the connection, and I totally agree. There's, you know, that's why I'm so pissed at people. I'm really pissed at this sticker thing, you know, people trying to take away stickers, because this is a special moment in somebody's life that they have waited for. And I've had friends that had single barrel picks that a friend had passed away, and they put them on the bottle to commemorate their friend. And it's like, why would you take that away from someone? You know, someone has that deep of a connection with your brand and that person, and you want to take that away from people? And I'm okay with that. What I'm annoyed by is the nuances of tears and, you know, whatever. If you're getting a dump date because it's a childhood birth, by all means. But if you're doing it just because that dump date's special, go to the different dump date.
The sun was facing towards the north side at 7 a.m.
If Oklahoma State ever wins a national championship in football, I'm getting a bottle of Blanton's that was dumped that day. Just saying.
And if they don't, you're going to find the DeLorean and go back, and we're going to find a goddamn barrel.
Well, by the way, they're not going to win a national championship in my lifetime. I mean, now that you can pay players, I mean, it's going to be like a line to Texas and Alabama.
So kind of like the last thing to try to find a silver lining here is let's say we're talking to not our regular podcast listeners here, and this is going to be for the general public or general audience out here, the ones that do stand in line for Blanton's because that's what they think is the best. What advice would you give a consumer about changing their habits of where they should spend their money?
So I'll just go from price point. You know, if they're spending what, $50-$60 on Blanton's, you know, I'd say, hey, go see what our buddies in New Riff or Wilderness Trail are doing. You know, they're a newer distillery, you know, see what they're, I think I had a Wilderness Trail pick this weekend at a local restaurant, and I was blown away. I was like, oh my gosh, it's, you know, a 5-year-old barrel. And it was, I think it was the weeded bourbon, and it was just mind blowingly good. It's just like, try something different. You know, I think, you know, not that Blanton's is bad, but I think you're going to find some nuance and different flavors in these other bottles at that price point. You know, same thing, you could sit down just like a Four Roses small batch or single barrel, you know, that's got great amount of complexity and flavor at that price range. But it's hard because the packaging is not as sexy as the perfume bottle and whatnot. But
so you're saying we need to give more advice to producers out there to create better glass? Is that what it is?
You know, I would say, look, you know, these are your, you love Kentucky bourbon. Okay, great. Well, there's basically five big players in the field. Go spend, say you're going to spend $30 at each distillery. Go spend, do that. And get a wide array of products from each distillery and find what you like, you know, not just because it's Blanton's, you know, and do it blindly and then say, okay, well, in the blind taste test, I really liked Elijah Craig or I liked Four Roses or this, you know, and then you can say, I'm buying this because I truly like it, not because somebody said I should like it.
And I think if that goes to your point is you should still go get that bottle of Blanton's and you should still do that and see if you still like that bottle of
Blanton's. Yeah, and throw it in the blind and maybe Blanton's wins. And if it does, then great. You know, it's great bourbon, you know, good, but it's not the only option out there.
So here's where I'm going to go with it. And this is going to be, I like people to find their own way. So before you buy a book, before you listen to a podcast, before you read a magazine article or do a Google, do what bourbon is all about and find some friends that are on the same journey as you. Go to a restaurant with a decent bourbon selection. I would, if you're in Kentucky, I'd say Bourbon's Bistro or Silver Dollar, two excellent places. Sit down over a month and have go to dinner together and have two bourbons with each meal. And like whether, you know, have it and taste it with your friends, talk about it and talk to the server or the bartender and learn from them, because bourbon is a communal, it's a social thing, and the hunt is an isolation. The buying and tasting yourself is an isolation, and bourbon is always meant to be enjoyed. And I'll tell you, I've drank my share of bourbon by myself, but there's nothing like sipping with my buddies. You know, there's nothing like sipping with you guys, or, you know, being out on a boat with my buddy, you know, Mark in Tennessee. There's nothing like that, that you have to experience your friends with bourbon in order to really appreciate bourbon. And that is how you go from being a hunter of Blanton's to a bourbon fan, as you appreciate bourbon for what it is. And it's a conduit for friendships.
Yeah, I can't tell me how many releases I have never drank by myself. But as soon as if somebody comes over, I'm like, please come try it, because I am never going to drink this by myself. And that's the more rewarding part of this whole thing is, you know, people just getting into it. You can introduce them to something and you have that connection. And it's all about the memories for me. And that's what I love about this hobby and this career and this category is I don't feel like this has ever happened when I've been to a winery or I've had, you know, high noons or, you know, we're not sitting there sharing, have you tried the mango high noon yet? Oh my gosh, can't wait till you come over, you know, but it all comes back to connection, community. And that's what we want this whole community to grow, not just be bottle chasers and selfishly hoarding everything for ourselves.
Right. So I think that's going to put a wrap on part one of Is Bourbon Broken? Looking at the consumer. So guys, thank you so much for...
This was a deep one, huh?
It did. I think this is going to go deep as we continue going here. Oh, so
I get some more caffeine.
Yes. So
Lauren, you'll be editing a lot.
She'll love it. But make sure you follow us on all the socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And also follow our friend Fred Minnick over here. Subscribe to his YouTube channel and subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Stay tuned for next week on the next episode in our series where we're going to look at the secondary market. Mm-hmm. With that, cheers, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Vodka sucks.